Hello, and welcome to the ADHD Manual Podcast. My name is Abby Miner. I'm a marriage and family therapist, an ADHD certified clinical services provider, and a proud ADHDer. This is a podcast for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and those who love us, which covers pretty much everybody. Growing up with a colorful brain in a black and white world can make us feel like aliens. The manual we've been given to guide us through life doesn't have any diagrams of the parts we've been given. I've decided to stop throwing away my parts and start throwing away this useless manual to write my own. So kick off your shoes, have a seat, and take a break from fitting yourself into a mold that's not your shape. You belong here. Allies, welcome to the ADHD planet. ADHDers, welcome home. Yeah, well, welcome to the ADHD Manual Podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Mike Howard, 31 years old and live here in Seattle.
Nice, cool. And you're my friend, you know, not a stranger picked up.
Yep.
So I knew your name and age.
I know, I was like, what do I say?
So I make it clear, okay?
Do I do like a fun fact? Like, is there like an icebreaker question or something?
Oh, that's a good idea. I didn't think about that. What's your favorite vacation spot?
Ooh, Tahoe.
Nice.
It's a family spot. And pretty much every birthday I think I've had since I was five, I've got to celebrate in Tahoe. So it's
nice.
A special spot.
Very cool. I don't know if I've been there. I might have. Something embarrassing, they get Tahoe and Tetons mixed up.
Ooh, I feel like I should know where the Tetons are. But if we played like National Park Geography or National Park Survey, you would not want me on your team.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Wyoming, maybe?
I think it is Wyoming.
I've been there. This is embarrassing. All right. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. I asked you to join me for a conversation about a center of a Venn diagram that we both live in, which is, you know, being some kind of in the LGBTQ community and also having ADHD.
Yep.
So I thought for Pride, we should get, you know, this is a great topic to tackle, because the overlap of those two things, of neurodivergence and queerness, is humongous, right? And I could not find a real number. I tried my best, but I imagine it's probably something that's very hard to really measure. But like I said, one survey that said like 70% of people who responded with autism also identified as non-heterosexual. And, you know, I've seen a lot of numbers thrown around, but it's just really, really huge.
Yeah, that seems really high.
But right?
I think it makes sense. I don't totally know why, but it does seem very high.
I know. I thought so, too. So it's hard to say, like, in general, the neurodivergence community, like, including ADHD and other types of, you know, neurotypes. So it's hard to say what that, you know, number would look like. I mean, is it specific to autism? We don't really know. But I can say specifically that in my experience, I know a lot of, I would say like a lot of the people I know in the queer community also have some sort of neurodivergence. That's a very common experience for me. Do you also have the same?
I would say what's kind of interesting for me is it wasn't really something I thought about or really even thought there was a connection, because I actually got my ADHD diagnosis a couple years after I came out.
Me too.
And even then, I came out when I was 26, a couple months before my 27th birthday. And to me, that feels really late. And so This kind of idea that a lot of this stuff got more clarity in my adulthood. It's interesting to like go back and think about my childhood being in school and, you know, was some of the behavior like trying to hide my sexuality, or was that just ADHD?
Yes.
Really, you know? And I don't know, but I think there's definitely a connection.
I think there's gotta be. I mean, yeah, and I don't really know why. I thought one thing we could do was just like wildly speculate, because that's enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think I also had the same experience. You know, I got diagnosed in adulthood after I came out, which was also in adulthood. So yeah, it's a lot of like, that was a really good point. Like, looking back at childhood, like, what was that?
Yeah.
Which was that? Hard to really tell. I think maybe part of the, if you had to, like, guess, I don't think there is an answer to this, so there's not a right answer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had to guess, like, which came first, what would you say? Like, which do you think lends itself to the other?
Yeah, I kind of had a feeling you were going to ask me that question. So I've been thinking about a good answer for that kind of all morning, and kind of terribly, my first answer is, I don't know.
No, we don't know.
I would say one thing that always surprises me, or surprises people when I sort of tell them my coming out story, is that I didn't really know that I was gay until I was a freshman in high school. And mm-hmm. for other people, that seems like super late, or you just like, you were kind of like lying to yourself. But it really, like, I really totally knew by that freshman year of high school. But when I was back home, one of the things I liked doing, and I was just, you know, I was telling you back home in California where I grew up for the first time in 2 years. And my mom kept a lot of stuff. She didn't keep my room intact, but she kept a lot of memorabilia and stuff like that. And I like to go look at old report cards, and
yes,
it's weird to me too why I like doing that, because my middle school and high school report cards were not that good. And one report card always stands out to me because I think it's 7th or 8th grade, and like each of our teachers like make a little paragraph, like they give you a grade, and then here's the comments on Mike or the student. And in one of them, three teachers, one called me Mike, one called me Michael, and then one called me Mikey. And so, like, just seeing, like, this singular report card, my name, like, three different ways, three different teachers, all, like, kind of viewing me with, like, a different identity or, like, personality. Mm-hmm. I think to me it's clear that some of that is obfuscating, like, mm-hmm. trying to hide my sexuality. And I think some of that, too, is I was probably a very non-out-of-the-box type student. I know teachers hated me or loved me, and I think I guess part of that was I just was very frantic, too. And so I think it makes sense that I also had a lot of personalities because I didn't really know what my singular one was.
Yeah. Nice. So you think the different names were kind of symbolic of all mm-hmm. the masks you had, so
exactly.
to speak?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Did you tell a difference, like, between, like, who was Michael? Like, who was Mikey?
I know. I was like, who was Michael? And I wonder, like, I'd say my parents and teachers and okay, probably everybody. So, like, not that I was the class clown, but I had the hardest time, like, staying focused. And I remember a 6th grade teacher, my math teacher, called my parents because he thought that maybe I had a bladder issue and needed to go to the doctor, because I would go to the bathroom in the middle of class, like clockwork, every day. Mm-hmm. And it's just because I couldn't, math just did not interest me.
Yeah.
And the idea of sitting there for 50 minutes, I just couldn't do it. So I'd go to the bathroom, probably like the 30-minute mark every
so
class
funny.
Period. And yeah, and like, I mean,
I'm sorry, it must have been embarrassing, but it's kind
I don't
of
think I
also.
Even knew about that. Or,
oh, okay.
It was something like maybe my parents had, like, a couple years later. But funnily enough, I had brunch with one of my middle school, and like, she actually then taught me in high school in New York, maybe when I was 28, and we like had brunch for 3 hours. It's a very weird experience where you're
That's
sitting
right.
across at a teacher who taught you when you were in 6th grade, and here you are, and you're on your second mimosa, and you're talking about what I was like as a student in middle school and high school. And she actually remembered that story, or I think I actually brought it
really?
Up, and because she had actually been not dating, but knew this math teacher very well. They both went to college together. And she said, oh, I cannot believe he did that. Like, we were so young. Like, he probably thought he was being helpful. But, yeah, she almost, like, kind of validated that. In another sense, I don't think I was always put in the best position to succeed in a lot of those kind of, like, school or academic type environments.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Did you have brunch with her after you were diagnosed?
So I had brunch with her after I had come out, but not before I was diagnosed.
Oh, okay. So you didn't have a lot of conversation about, like...
But I think she would have already diagnosed me myself. And I think she even... She was one of those teachers because she... When we graduated high school, a teacher would come up and... Like, there was 150 kids in my class, so not super big. And a teacher would kind of give, like, a tribute and, you know, take 30 seconds. And she was the one who gave mine. And it made total sense because I think she was one of the only ones who still enjoyed teaching me, even when I was kind of a disaster. You know, when I wasn't turning my homework or I was forgetting my assignments and could never remember to bring a pen or a pencil to class. And I think she didn't punish me for that. She just knew that there was something else that I was struggling with.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. It's great to have a teacher like that.
Yeah.
Nice. Did you have a conversation about, you know, looking back on your childhood after you came out? Did you have that conversation with her, or did that not come up?
I think I don't totally remember the specifics, but I think, you know, in another sense, I got very good at hiding it. And in terms of just my sexuality, I think she definitely saw like the learning challenges of ADHD, but I think she also knew something else was like consuming me, for lack of a better phrase. And I think
even before you were aware of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or even in high school, just seeing this like change in this very kind of loud, gregarious, like sixth grader, and, you know, wanting to challenge the status quo in like probably more healthy ways. And then by high school, just being very much more reserved and like very much more unfocused and probably more unhealthy ways in that regard.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So maybe like hiding your sexuality impacted your ADHD symptoms.
It has to. And I think like,
yeah, totally makes sense.
But, and I was trying to think of specific examples where maybe that I can like, yes, there's proof. Like it was this math class or this, and I don't have any, but I don't know. I think part of it was not also just wanting to tip my hand anywhere. And I think you can do that by doing more activities, by trying harder, by being a better student. And I think I was also afraid to do that just because I didn't want to expose myself. And so I had this weird sense of not almost being able to harness, not harness is the right word, but not even wanting to tackle the ADHD thing, just because I knew that to me, that wasn't the issue. It was this other thing that I was hiding.
Mm. So not excelling in school allowed you to be invisible? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Hard to say. I mean, they definitely impact each other. You're absolutely right. That's a really good point. Yeah, and then, of course, you know, if you throw trauma in there, which is, you know, definitely more likely to impact all parts of us, right? Like, queer people and neurodivergent people are very likely to experience trauma, so that could definitely throw a wrench into it. So hard to say, but I can't make a good segue. I don't remember if you said something that is connected to this, but what I'm thinking of, I don't know if it's connected, is that, like, what I think, and maybe it's just that, like, overall, like, most of the time, neurodivergence is innate, right? We're born with it. And then, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, believe that we're born a certain way, you know, gender identity or sexual orientation-wise. But I don't think that's always the case. And I think that used to kind of be like a secret among us, right? Like, you know, we had to tell the straights, like, no, we're born this way. Okay. Get
right.
on our backs. But like, you know, we're like, no, it's okay. We can change. But I think it's a little more safe to admit that. But I wonder if like, I just think a lot about like growing up neurodivergent, especially not knowing it, is that like, I just had to live differently.
Yeah.
You know, like I had to like constantly question, like, okay, this is how everyone else is doing it, but should I do that? And like, just that constant self-checking of like, you know, I was just talking to my therapist about this, that kind of it's very common for me to need to check myself against everyone else.
Yep.
And like figure out like if my actions or if my emotional responses are normal, you know, like I often get my cues about how should I feel about this, like from other people. So I think that growing up, you know, queer also was part of that, right? It's just that constant like checking of like, wait, like, you know, how much of this is normal and I should be feeling it, and how much of this is like clearly not normal and we need to like tamp that shit down, you know?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I kind of go back to like one of the ADHD symptoms I definitely showed was just completely unorganized all the time when I was younger. And I remember reading a BuzzFeed article, this was probably about a year ago, when I was super into BuzzFeed at the start of the pandemic, and like I don't really know why, and it was one of those things like, here's where these 10 like personas of people are today. And like and one of the personas was the guy always asking, the guy or woman, like, always asking for a pen or pencil in class. And, like, that was totally me.
Yes.
And I just, it's, thinking about it, part of it was so uncontrollable. I literally could not keep pens or pencils. Like,
no, me neither. They literally disappear.
I swear, there's a whole area in this world that are just all my socks and pens and pencils from growing. And, like, I don't know what they're doing. They're probably having an amazing party, but I have lost. Even yet, I think it was 2 days ago, I was at chat. I was like, hey, do you have a pen? Because I wanted to take notes for a call at work. Like, I just cannot keep track of that kind of stuff. And I think how that ties to my sexuality then too is, to me, that was a sign from people around me that I didn't take things seriously, or I didn't care. Mm. And this idea that it wasn't that I didn't care, but maybe that I wasn't good enough. And I think having that sense of, again, hiding your queerness and your sexuality, you're basically telling yourself, I'm hiding this because something's wrong with me.
Yes.
And so then when you put that on, the going back to the pencils as well, there's something wrong with me. That's why I can't keep track of pens. And that had nothing to do with the fact that I was gay. It just,
right.
I just can't keep pens together.
Right. But the feeling is very similar.
Right.
Yeah. Like there's something shameful about who I am naturally.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so true. That's so valid. Yeah. And just that, having to, especially like, I'd be curious to talk to like somebody who maybe was diagnosed with neurodivergence early on or came out early on. And
yeah.
I wonder if that would be a different experience. Just as I wonder what kind of layer it adds to like be experiencing the world in a certain way and have no idea why, you know, like I just have a lot of curiosity about that. But I know like just that, even though it was a lot of like checking myself to, you know, try to fit in, right, in some way or another, like, I do think in a way, since I came out after, no, sorry, I came out before I got diagnosed, I wonder if a lot of that has helped me being, like, a queer person in, a same-sex relationship, like, as an adult, and, especially, like, a lot of, like, the adulthood things that we are, like, you know,
terrible told,
like
at,
this,
yeah.
You're terrible.
See,
yes,
like, this
for
is me
sure.
already, like,
yeah,
being like, oh yeah, I can't do these things, or I'm bad at these things, right? It's that not like self-deprecating, but that inherent sense that we're just not as good as everybody else. I would say
definitely, yeah. There's definitely that, and but I also wonder, like, if it's been a little helpful as like someone who's basically had to make up my own adult experience, you know, like. There's not really, I mean, there, of course, and, you know, there are a lot of people who are older and who have, like, fought to live their lives authentically and shown a different, you know, different way to be an adult, different way to have a family, you know, different way, like, so there is some examples, but there's just not as many examples of, like, okay, I'm an adult, I love this person, now what do I do, you know, like, you know, like having, starting a family and getting married and like, there's so much gendered and like heteronormative expectations around those big milestones that as a queer person, you just have to throw out the window, you know, and you just have to make it up as you go along. And I think as a neurodivergent person, I'm very familiar with that, right? Like, I don't know, I can't do this way. So I guess I'll just make up something else.
Yeah. You know? I do appreciate that kind of sense of kind of figuring out as things go on. And like, it's even chatting last night and texting about like, oh, do I need to prepare for this? Like, how should I be ready? And when you use the phrase winging it and like that specific phrase. And
I
feel like I do that in one sense where I say I fly by the seat of my pants a lot. And
that's how I live.
And one sense I love that about myself is that I can get thrown into a situation maybe unexpectedly and I'll figure it out and like usually I'll be pretty good at it, but if you give me time to think about that situation and then start then like, oh my god, you were like, where's Mike? And it's like, oh, he left, like he's gone, he's not coming. It's this constant like push pull to, I think sometimes I don't even know what my authentic identity is. And I think I probably said I think at this point about 100 times, but part of this is I didn't form an identity growing up, and then once I came out and once I had that diagnosis and I really got to understand some of the more, like, for lack of a better, scientific foundational things about me, then it kind of allowed, gave me this opportunity to be like, well, what do I want my identity to be? And how can I forge it knowing that I have more tools and I'm better equipped because I know more things about myself? And so in one sense, I feel kind of lucky.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's a lot of stuff. I mean, like, there's definitely a lot of stuff about being queer and having ADHD that is very hard, which we'll talk about in a minute. But like, I also think that I wouldn't change it. Like, I wouldn't change either part of that, a part of myself. Yeah, I definitely think it's hard to extract any of it. You know, it's hard to extract my queerness from my ADHD, and it's hard to extract, you know, my core self from either of those things. You know, it's not really I can divide it up either way. I think I saw like this like meme a long time ago about how like the Venn diagram of like queer people and either ADHD or neurodivergent people, like the connecting Venn diagram is that we can't sit normally.
Yeah.
It was something about like queer people can't just sit in chairs,
nope.
You know, and neither can people with ADHD, you know, it's always like, you know, twining our legs in some way and, you know, sitting on cross-legged or whatever. So it's like, it's kind of like that, you know, it's just this constant, like, you know, out of the norm, having to just get used to being okay with
it. Blows my mind when I see Chad, my partner, and he works down on the first floor of where we live, and I am constantly moving around. Like, I'll be on the couch, I'll go up to the bedroom, I'll sit, like, on the bed, I'll use the desk. Like, I don't have a central working area. The whole, like, house is, like, my working area, basically. And then Chad can go and sit down in that first floor office room for, like, 3 hours, come up for lunch, you know, we'll kind of chat, then he goes back down, and then he'll come back up at, you know, 4 or 5, and it just blows my mind that he can sit still in that single room for like more than an hour. Cause I'm already looking at the clock that we've been talking for 22 minutes and like,
really?
Wow. I'm like, how have I sat still for this long?
And I know, right?
It's so hard.
Yeah. Well, we haven't really.
Yeah. No, I've been like already moving.
Fidgeting,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
But, that is so funny. I actually have like, I've gotten really mad at Hum for being so consistent.
Yep.
And it just pisses me off for some reason.
Drives me crazy.
I don't know why. Yeah. Like, she literally comes out of the office and has lunch at the exact same time every day. And I'm like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And it pisses me off that you do that. Like, there's no reason I should be mad.
And like, in one sense, it's been nice. I mean, not nice, but just working remotely last year and making that transition. It's like not only just having one person around me who can sit still like that, being in an office space where you see all these other people, then you really feel that sense of you're different and why do I need to take 4 walks throughout the day? And somebody's like, well, I never take a walk. I'm just like, not like, oh, you should, but like, how do you not have to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. You used to work in like an open office space.
Mm-hmm.
Was that really hard?
I liked it. And one thing that I really liked about it, and I think I've missed the past years, kind of the franticness of just other noises and people moving around. For example, I could never study in a library. It's too quiet.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's too focused. Like, I need the distractions to actually find my own focus spot. And so I think that's also why I just miss being in office, because I want those distractions, because then to me that's stimulating and then I can actually, again, like, focus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. You know, it's that bad filtering system, right? Like, see, there has to be, like, completely silent or, like, very noisy, nothing in between.
Yep.
Like, a library is very in between, and I agree, I hate that.
Yeah.
But you also had, like, the body doubling aspect of it, too, though, right? Like, being around other people who are also working can be really helpful.
Yeah, and I think it just gives me a sense, too, if I see, other people focusing or locked in, it's like, if they can do that for 2 hours, I can do this for 30 minutes or something, and yeah, I just miss the natural, because I'd say I'm naturally introverted, and so I think also, like, just commuting and, like, being in, like, going to get coffee and walking with people, I think it just also helps me be more sociable and make friends.
Totally.
A lot of the people that I hang out with, you know, like, for instance, here, right, is through meeting Hum, through work, and
right.
I'd be like, oh, Hum's great, like, I really want to be friends with Hum, and, like, just knowing, having that kind of work environment that enables me to meet other people in that, like, more social setting versus having to do that by going to a party or a bar,
right,
or going to a sporting event. Like, I almost need that forced interaction.
Yeah, right. Do people actually make friends at, like, bars and sporting events?
That I'm always amazed that people just have so many friends. I'm like,
seriously,
how do you keep track of all
any
that?
Any adult, what is that thing about, like, about Jesus being, like, the real miracle is that he had 12 adult friends or something?
Oh my God.
In his 30s.
That is incredible.
Like, it's very true.
Is that a high number? Is that a low number? Is that a...
That seems high to me.
Yeah.
Do you have 12 friends?
No. I feel like if I had to do a
12-person
dinner party...
Right?
I could get there, but...
That sounds terrible, but
yeah.
Also, like, I don't even know who I would invite. No, that's so right. Yeah, I wonder if that's part of adulthood, right? Like, we just meet friends through our work, because that's where we are most of the time.
Yeah.
I guess that's just being an adult, but sucks.
It's funny because I also don't really like parties, though. Even just talking
about
that, I was, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. I love dinner parties, though, and it goes back to that like forced interaction where it's like a forced activity. It's like, all right, I know that we're going to have like a meal. We're going to all be forced to sit down. I'll probably be anxious about like the seating assignments and that kind of thing. But yeah, the open-ended, like, well, how long are we going to be there for? If we're going to a picnic or like a backyard barbecue, it's like, well, what activities are we going to do? Chad and his family, I love going over there. His mom and dad and brother are so nice, but they just like to sit in the living room when we go over there and talk. And I can do that for about 20 minutes. And then I'm like, well, should we get like an assigned list of topics? Like, are we going to sit here for an hour? Like, what's going on? Because my family, we just don't do that. We're bad at it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Sitting and talking?
Yeah, we just, we need some type of like inciting incident or like actual activity for us to do that.
Hmm, interesting. Is there other ADHD in your family, do you think?
I would say no. Like, my sister is just super type A, wants to take over the world, and she's great. Like,
there are ADHD people like that.
Yeah, and my brother, easily one of the smartest people I know. He was a physics major in college, and I could barely pass freshman year of physics in high school. And so I think I'm smarter than my brother in a lot of different ways, but in just, like, that core, like, intelligence, my brother's pretty incredible. Then my mom and dad are very similar to both of them, so I definitely have always viewed myself as the black sheep of my family.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, people with ADHD are very intelligent, so I'm curious, like, you don't seem like you see yourself as smart as your family.
I would say that like communication, so it was one of the really interesting things of, I had a therapist in New York who, I don't say that she changed my life. I said that, like, she saved my life. Like, just totally, like, allowed me to think about things in a way that it wasn't negative about myself, but it was like, no, like, that makes sense that this happened to you. Like, that, they're like, you can learn from this and make it a positive. And one of the things she said, maybe after, like, a year of us talking, because it took me about 6 to 8 months to actually start saying things to her that had substance, and she goes, your family is terrible at communicating with each other. And I was like, yes. Oh my God, they're terrible. She goes, like, yeah, like, trust me, you guys are really bad at it. And really, it was super validating because, I don't know, it just, again, seeing, like, Chad's parents, they can just sit and talk in that living room for, like, 4 hours. And I feel terrible because I'm like, Chad, like, can we just, like, when are we going to go? I can sit here, but you just got to tell me when we're going to leave. But, yeah, communication has definitely always been hard for me.
Yeah. Well, there are definitely other ways to communicate, right? Rather than just sitting and talking. I mean, activities together is also communicating and relationship forming.
Yeah. And kind of in that sense, I always knew writing was easier for me, like talking out loud as well. And so really when I first started telling coming out, right, I had to say something. But like when I started to kind of tell the story about it, like I wrote about it. I forget how long I wrote that blog, for maybe 8 months or something. And that was a huge breakthrough because then I was able to just kind of do the same thing where you'd say something out loud and you, like, you lose ownership of it. You've given it to the world. And then once you can kind of see it away from you, you're like, oh, that's an irrational anxiety, or, oh, that's a fear I don't need to have. And writing just allowed me to do that a lot easier and a lot faster.
That's a great point about ownership. That's so true. When you say things out loud, it's, it's not yours anymore. But writing is kind of always yours.
Yeah.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, that's true. I guess what I'm wondering is that, like, is there parts of your ADHD that are, that you see some commonality with your family? And what am I saying? I'm saying, like, were you able to see yourself in your family with your ADHD in a way you couldn't with your queerness? Does that make sense? Like, you felt like the black sheep. Do you know how much of it is which, or?
Yeah. And I think I always just describe that, again, back to, like, the queerness, the sexuality, and the sense that that was what was wrong with me. And that's what kind of flowed through every other facet of my life. And the clothes I wore, the friends I made, where I wanted to go to school, what I wanted to do for a living, like, what my hobbies were. And I really wonder, too, if that just was such a, probably was a wrong falsehood I had my entire, really, until getting diagnosed when I was 29. And so it was this huge aha moment where the psychiatrist who diagnosed me in New York, I think the intake session was like 2.5 hours. And it was like one of those things where I easily could have stayed there and talked. I wanted to talk to him all day because I feel like I just, and he goes, yeah, I don't know how you weren't diagnosed before. Like, it's so clear to me. Like, I was, you know, it's doing the same story about not keeping track of pencils and, mm-hmm. you know, all those little details. And he's like, yeah, it's so obvious. And I do remember getting tested when I was younger and, like...
Oh, really?
And, like, you know... It was like two sessions at this one guy, and there was this full, like, basically, like, mental, like, report of Mike and, like, all my, like, motor skills and, like, memory, you know, basically, like, a standardized test for, like, youth behavior or something. I don't really know what it is.
And you weren't diagnosed with that?
No, and I think part of the problem was is that when you put me in that, like, focused setting where it was me, one other person, I knew exactly how long I was going to be there. Mm-hmm. I didn't, like, get bored. I knew I kind of wanted to do well. It was interesting. And, yeah. And so I, like, scored really well. And then I was like, well, it was almost I think my parents were almost flustered when they got that back because they said, well, they wanted to find something and they couldn't. And so I think to me then that confirmed again that it wasn't an ADHD thing. It was the fact that I'm gay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true. That's why those tests are bad.
Yeah. No, for sure.
They're not useful. Yeah. I have a whole episode talking about how terrible that is, you know. People are using these cognitive tests to diagnose when it's just not accurate.
Yeah.
But yeah, wow. Can you talk more about how there was a moment in your childhood where you thought you might have some sort of diagnosis that would explain a lot for you, and you didn't get that, and so the gayness kind of,
yeah.
you know.
You mean in the sense of, like, so this one example where thinking that maybe I'd have a diagnosis and that just didn't come up and being, mm-hmm. like, disappointed by it, or...
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, to be honest, because I think there was already so much going on in my head that maybe... I don't think I was... I don't want to say... like emotionally intelligent or smart, but I don't know if it was something I would have been able to like process or think about either. Because I started seeing
diagnosis?
Yeah. I started seeing a therapist like for talk therapy my second semester of my freshman year of high school, and I saw him for 3 years and nothing, totally worthless. And not because the talk therapy was worthless, because I was not emotionally ready to talk about any of the things that were actually meaningful and bothered me in my life. And it really wasn't until it was like my fourth therapist, and after like 6 months, I don't remember what the breakthrough was, but like it just clicked. And I think it's because I started to actually trust her, mm-hmm. and it just took a while to get there. But yeah, I think I just had convinced myself that there was nothing like from a learning perspective wrong with me. I think I just thought something was wrong with me, because the other thing is I've probably spent half of my life depressed.
Yeah.
And so if it wasn't the ADHD, it was the fact that I knew that I was clinically depressed and then super anxious all the time. And I wonder if a lot of the anxiety, though, really was more symptoms of ADHD, too.
Oh, for sure. For sure. There's a lot that's very anxiety-producing about ADHD.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to get ready in time for you to come over, you know, like, which
well,
I did not.
It was funny because I knew it was like, okay, 2 o'clock, Chad, we should leave at 1:15. It's going to take us 45 minutes.
Oh, my
and
God.
I said, wait, no, I know, Abby, we're early by being on time. And I mean that in the nicest way possible.
No, because, you're absolutely right.
Because my thing is, like, God, I bet Abby's wondering at, like, this morning, 10, 11, if I'm going to text her. And she's like, nope, can't make it, I'm out. Because that is my other thing, is my, like, avoidance strategy is very high. My therapist now in Seattle talks about that all the time, that's my primary solution for solving problems is just avoiding them.
I mean, it works a lot of the time, to
be
fair. Yeah, that's true. Do you feel like there's some of your avoidance is related to being queer also?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Because I think that was the first major problem, or that was the strategy that I used all the time, was avoiding things. And you said something earlier that was really interesting to me about how you would constantly kind of be looking around at other people's behavior and said, is my behavior normal? I think I did something similar, but the way that I wasn't looking around as my behavior normal compared to everybody else, I just wasn't doing any of those behaviors. So, like, I wasn't putting myself in the situation where, oh, I could be invited to a party and then being anxious about going to that party. I just wouldn't make the connections with people to get invited to that party, if that makes sense. So this sense of avoidance and just not isolation is too strong a word, but hiding, I would say.
Yeah. So you didn't even have a lot of opportunities to kind of self-check your behavior against other people's?
Yeah, because I think I just didn't put myself in the situation to have that opportunity to do that.
Makes sense.
You know, whether it was sports, I think I quit playing organized sports teams when I was sophomore in high school, and then I started to do like track and cross country, and I think part of that too was like the just environment of a sports team and male, and again knowing that I was gay and like, oh, I can't play football even though I really want to, and also because I was 5'5", 110 pounds, like I would never have gotten on the field. But I stopped doing things that I enjoyed because I didn't want to, I didn't want to be exposed again.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, for sure. I feel like I have a lot of those moments with both being queer and having ADHD.
Yeah.
Of like, and I think something that's I've been thinking about a shared experience between, you know, being queer and also having ADHD is that with ADHD, I felt like I have to come out all the time also.
Yeah.
You know, like, as we know, like, coming out is not a one-time thing. We do it constantly.
Yep.
So I think I feel similarly about ADHD in that, like, even, like, people I've told before I have ADHD, it's like I constantly have to remind them.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, I'm sure they get sick of me talking about it, but, like, it impacts everything.
Yeah.
And I think, actually, now that I say it, I think that's probably a similar experience I feel both ways because, like, you hear that criticism, of queer people too, right? Like, oh, well, I don't mind queer people as long as they just, you know, don't talk about it too much.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
It's so silly, as if it's not something that impacts every single facet of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that way about ADHD too. It's like, I will never stop talking about it because it literally affects everything,
yeah.
You know? So it's, you know, it's impossible to, you know, separate it from who I am and that kind of like constantly having to, I think exposure was a great way that you put it. Just, like, constant exposure.
Yep.
You know? What did you experience after you came out? Like, what was that exposure feeling like for you? Was it terrifying? Was it freeing?
It was incredibly liberating. It was kind of the, like, almost this, basically, the way I phrase it, like, your life kind of, or, like, my life basically started from that point. And
mm-hmm.
One thing that was interesting to me was realizing that the people that I was hiding the most from was my immediate family.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the first four people that I came out to. And then once I came out to them, then it was meaningless telling everybody else. It didn't matter anymore, right? Because they still loved me. And so that's, to me, what mattered the most. And so then when you were telling, like, extended family or, like, it didn't matter anymore. It's like the kind of the blanket had been, or the Band-Aid had just been fully ripped off. And so then it wasn't hard to tell other people.
That's interesting. So you cared the most about their reactions.
Yeah.
And you told them first?
Yep.
That's brave.
I think because it didn't, well, I would say, you know, I mean, I definitely told people before, but it was more the, like, hush, hush, like, you can't tell anybody, you know, like, but actually living as a gay person, I think that starts with coming out to the people who I think would have, I don't know if that sounds bad or so, like, prevented me from living as a, but, and, like, loving me as that same version of myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or more authentic version.
Like, re-getting to know you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's tough because, like, my coming out was not was not planned.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents kind of find out by accident. So I didn't really have that whole sit-down, I have something to tell you moment. I was living with them at the time when I was starting to date, and so they're, you know. And there's definitely part of that that I'm kind of, like, kind of miffed about. Like, I kind of missed that moment. It was kind of taken away from me in a sense. But, like, I mean, it was, you know. If anything, like, I remember my dad saying, like, well, why didn't you tell us?
Yeah.
Like, why did you feel like you couldn't tell us that? And I was like, well, did Joe tell you that he's straight? Did he, like, come out to you straight? And he's like, that's true. That's a good point.
And I think if he's asking that question, he's almost answering it by asking the question because he's, you know, why did you not take some specific action? Mm-hmm. Why did, the onus was on you? And I think sometimes maybe at least for me in my situation, the reason I didn't do that was all the cues I was getting from people around me, whether that was peers, that was my family, that was, you know, don't know what other group of people you are when you're dead, but like was telling me that's not okay, that you cannot be gay. And I just think so, and I, you know, kind of going back to your question about was this ADHD, was just like you're hiding your sexuality. I think a lot of that anxiety fills that Venn, or is that Venn diagram, right? Where mm-hmm. some is it coming from both places, and I'm now really curious about if I wish more of my anxiety is really coming from ADHD instead. Because now that I don't have that shame and guilt, but I'm still the same person who can't stay organized very well, like, it's pretty clear that that was more of the driving issue, probably. Yeah. Or driving factor, I should say.
That's a great point, yeah. Yeah, I think that's really true. I had a thought that I lost. What you made me think of is that, right, you answered the question by asking it. It's like, something you said really there reminded me of ADHD as well, in the sense that we have this perception that it's always our job as part of both groups to accommodate everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, and to, you know, come out to everybody else, and that there's very little, like, reciprocation of, like, you know, I was just reading an interesting article of, like, okay, fine, I was skimming it. I did have the energy to read the whole thing, but it was an interesting point about, like, any social skill, you know, training or program or, like, you know, therapy is not inherently neurodivergent affirming.
Yeah.
Like, you can't teach social skills without, you know, trying to, you know, negate the neurodivergence out of somebody. Which was interesting because I know a lot of people who are neurodivergent who really want to be more social and want to feel like they can connect with other people more. And so that was interesting, like a reaction I had to reading that. But I think what it also made me think of is that, like, how unfair it is that we have to learn the social skills, right? It's like communicating with anybody is hard, and it's going to take, like, people communicate in 1,000 different ways. It's always going to take some sort of give and take. And why do we always have to be the ones that are, like, you know, giving?
Yeah. I really appreciate that about, like, learning social skills, or, like, being, like, feeling like there's things that other people are doing that we either don't know how to do or mm-hmm. just don't have the ability to do it. And I think a good example of that for me is, like, networking events, cocktail parties, like, large group gatherings where it's just a bunch of people milling around and talking. Yeah. I don't understand why we do that as a society, or why people, like, yes. It is my just least favorite thing to do in the world. But what amazes me, it seems like everybody else loves it and, like, loves going around and having a hunt, like, speed social, like, not even, like, speed dating actually. There's an end goal, yeah. Right? And I wonder, too, it going backward, like, kind of, is that ADHD or is that, like, sexuality? Mm-hmm. Or not, well, like, is the one as a factor, but feeling like, everyone else enjoys this, people like having this talking. I can't do that. I mm-hmm. feel less than because I'm incapable of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, again, if that just ADHD, or is what I told myself is, it's because I am not interesting because I'm not being truthful to people. If they ask mm-hmm. me if I'm dating somebody and I hadn't come out yet, I didn't really have a very, very good answer or a way to not just say, nope, not right now. Like, that's not a very good conversation starter.
Right.
And so, yeah, just not knowing who I was, I think, and maybe where that anxiety was coming from.
Yes. Yeah. And you made a good point about, like, you know, the amount of energy it takes to hide certain parts of yourself.
It's it's exhausting.
It's definitely very liberating to come out in one sense. And, like, you made a good point about, like, when I came out, I was liberated, but then still some of my symptoms didn't disappear. And then I'm like, oh, okay, now I have to, like, I guess do more digging, you know?
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I felt that way, too, of, like, in both senses. Like, I feel like I had more energy after I came out, and I felt like I was living more authentically. And then, you know, the reverse as well, when I stopped spending so much energy trying to, like, being neurotypical, you know, I did have more energy to figure out, like, okay, well, who am I actually?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, and, you know, my wife and we're awesome, and she's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. She's very accepting. She's never said, like, I don't think she's ever looked at anybody and said, like, that was weird. You know, I can't imagine her doing that.
Yeah.
But in this, she's been out of town for a couple weeks, and just in the time that I've been alone, I've been able to be alone for, honestly, probably the first time ever. Like, I've always had to have a roommate, or, like, I've never been able to afford living on my own. And, like, I'm noticing that, like, there are some parts of me that I do have more energy, because I can be weirder.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't really have to explain myself, you know, and I told her that, and, like, there's definitely some parts of, like, I don't know, it's mostly, like, I'm talking all the time. That's the biggest part of it, and it's, like, it's not that's, like, and I say, like, oh, I talk to myself, or I talk to the cat all the time, and that's, you know, it's easier to do that when she doesn't always think that I'm talking to her, right?
Yeah.
But, like, I don't even say, like, coherent things either. Like, sometimes I just say things just to hear them, you know? Like, I have, like, tics where, like, I will repeat things, like...
Almost because you want to hear, like, your own voice, or you want to hear, like, just more sounds when you're alone?
I don't know what it is, but there's something, like, it's definitely, like, repeating things. Like, I'll hear, like... you know, a line in a TV show that I just, like, repeat over and over again, or, like, a commercial, or, like, a jingle, or it's so silly. I don't know why. It's just, like, worms, like, earworm things.
You know, that's really funny, because one thing I didn't know about myself until I started dating Chad, and we moved in together, and, you know, basically spending, especially when the first 6 months of the pandemic, where we were in a studio apartment with our two cats who didn't get along, both working, you know, nonstop, and being on phone call, like...
Yeah,
I still
in the
no
same
I-
place.
Yeah,
I
have
the same
no
place.
Idea how we did that.
Me neither.
And one of the things, like, I realized, like, I have, like, catchphrases. And it's, the weird thing about it is it changes and rotates, like, every 4 to 6 weeks. And I can't even remember what some of the ones I had were, like, last spring or in the early summer. And sometimes they're just, like, words I'll make up. Like, I don't even want to say the current one I have now. But it sounds like this, like, German word that I'll say that's, like, I don't, like, it's weird, but, like, and I couldn't, almost wouldn't want to have it other way. Like, I love that about myself, and
yeah.
I love that Chad loves that, but it just, I'm just kind of so glad that somebody else, like, has that same thing to do.
I'm really glad you said that, too. So, the same as that line, I was like, oh, man, this is, jeez. Yeah, and maybe I will, you know, talk to her. I just wasn't realizing... And it's something that you do without, you know, not consciously, too, right? Just, like, I didn't realize how much energy I was expending trying to be normal, you know, like, in every sense, you know, and being queer and also having ADHD and, like, yeah, it's really fascinating.
I think you brought up a good point about just the energy level and the exhaustion that it comes with, is that I think what sometimes people don't realize is if... You know, maybe we're, you know, my dad would say that, you know, this was a sign of laziness that, or my mom was like, how come you're not, you don't want to leave the house this weekend or something. And she, and I'm sort of thinking like, you, like, I'm thinking about that starting on Tuesday. It's like, all right, I know my mom's going to say, what are my social plans for this weekend? And so I'm like, it's Tuesday. So I have like 3 more days till Friday or something. And it's weird how, not weird, I don't want to say that, but that constant sense of foreboding, thinking about the future, what is the next shoe that's going to drop, and then not knowing what that is, almost being just as anxious about that, it really does wear you out. I think I totally appreciate your comment about having more energy after you came out the diagnosis, because you had some, you knew something now about yourself you didn't have to worry about, or you now was going to have access to more tools or more guidance on how you don't have to worry about some of those things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so fascinating. Yeah, I love what you said about dreading the future, because there is a little bit of that in both. You know, it, with ADHD, I want to say with ADHD specifically, just because other types of neurodivergence I'm not as familiar with, this might be a, you know, universal neurodivergent experience, but, like, the inability to kind of conceptualize the future is, like, a really present element of ADHD, right? Just, like, not... You know, and that was part of a, I don't remember if I talked to you about this, but, like, part of what was so scary about quitting my job and why it took me so long to, like, really, you know, just gear up to do it is that, like, I knew I needed a break. I knew I needed to just not work. And I've never done that before. You know, it's just never, and I realized how much of, oh, I said this in a past episode, maybe, how much of, like, going from one job to the next kind of felt like filled that deficit of, like, not being able to picture the future. If I had a job to go to, like, I could see the future, but now I can't. It's just black, you know? Like, and I think there's a lot about, like, being queer, even if you don't know it, where, like, you just can't picture your future, you know? You don't know what you want it to look like. You don't know, like, other people who have lived the way you want to and just have, just constantly, like, trudging forward into just blackness.
Yeah. I'm happy for you because I think you're going to have this sensation, and I feel like I don't know, sensation word, but there was a period of time before I moved to Seattle where I wasn't working, and I remember talking to, I think it was my sister, and she goes, like, so what do you do all day? Like, what are you doing? You know, and, like, it's a good question in the sense I know what her intent was, like, what are you, like, how are you spending your time? Yeah. Not, like, productively, but I think she was worried about me, frankly, and really what I did before I ended up at this job at SkillDrive where I met Hum and now, you know, progressing this conversation, like I made therapy my job. And I think I started going either twice a week. Yeah. I started going twice a week. And at this point I fully trusted this therapist in New York. And so like every session was like, I had that like aha moment. And she had this concept of, what she called them, like door bombs, where like, right as I'm walking out the door like closing in, I'd be like, I'd say one of those bombs and leave. Right, exactly. And like,
yeah.
I got better, or we started to kind of not manipulate my behavior, but like take advantage of my behavior, knowing like, all right, when I'm gonna be more comfortable where it makes sense to talk about something. Mm-hmm. If I'm gonna do a door bomb, then let's know. Then we start the next session. Let's start with that door bomb. Let's not like forget that. And so we almost kind of like weaponized like the parts of my personality that made therapy hard and kind of like gamified them a little bit. And then made it a lot easier for me to like quite literally come out to her in that sense. I feel like I totally just also lost my train of thought.
No, I know what you mean. Like, that's so funny. Yeah. I'm glad that she called you out on that because like we, in the therapy world, we call it doorknobbing.
Doorknobbing. Like, okay. Yeah.
You're like, oh, my client doorknobbed me today. Just happened to drop that, you know, their sister was murdered like ages ago, you know? So like, yeah, that's so funny that she called. And I bet going often, more often, like, kind of helped with that, right? So there's less time in between, you know, like, forgetting what you dropped.
And, like, another example of that, too, with her was, not that I was, okay, I was definitely flaky, where, especially early on, where maybe I didn't feel like I could be good in therapy, which sounds weird, but, or you probably know exactly what I'm talking about, but feeling I needed to have some story to tell to her that day or some problem I was working on. And not that I didn't, because I definitely did, but I didn't feel capable of like chatting through it. And so basically what I would say is, oh yeah, like I'm running 15 minutes late. And then I just wouldn't show up, or I just wouldn't show up and gives her like heads up notice. And eventually she's like, you know, we're going to talk about this. Like, you can't just like not have this consistent pattern of behavior and like then show up, you know, once or twice a month or something. And, like, have a good session. Like, let's talk about why you're not showing up. And doing that was really helpful because I think it was in those moments I feel like I was going to let her down. And then the shame of being like, I can't come today. And then the lying kicks in where, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll be there. And then just not showing up in the first place. And again, she's like, all right, so like we taught it through that. And it's like, next time that happens, like you can just like cancel or be like, come for 10 minutes and you can leave. And I don't know, just again, like made me feel better about the fact that I didn't want to go. Because sometimes too, that this, I think this is ADHD, where like a 60-minute session, it's like, what are all my talking points for 60 minutes? Like, and being worried that it's going to be 20 minutes in and I don't know what to say. She's not saying anything. And then just, that makes me really nervous.
Oh yeah. I feel like both as a client and a therapist, you know, like I have to have an agenda.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely, yeah, some anxiety in that. And yeah, the avoidance that you mentioned, that's coming back, right? Yeah. Interesting. I'm wondering if there's like any, maybe we already talked about this, but like that tendency to like the shame for not being able to show up and like the lying and like, I wonder if there's any of that that can be tied to the queer experience as well. I'm just mulling it over. It's like, you know, like I can imagine I probably had moments where like I said it was going to be somewhere, but you know, something related to queerness or not being out or not like, or having some sort of shame around my sexuality made me just avoid it altogether. And like, you know, how much of, I wonder how much harm I did to my relationships because, you know, of something that was going on with me that I wasn't fully understanding or fully honest about. And it was almost like I would, there'd be moments where I would think I'm like protecting other people from like, you know, disengaging or like stepping back or whatever, when really I was harming them. Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. Yeah. And you said something earlier too about going back and like changing, you know, would you have come out earlier? Would you have tried to go out and seen a doctor earlier to get, you know, that diagnosis? And I think when I first came out, ultimately, I really wanted to go back and like rewrite everything. Like, mm-hmm. and I, not that I blamed other people, but I think I totally did. Because I wanted to go back and change things and get like, well, why did this happen? Like, why was I feel like I was put in a position to not only not succeed, but almost set up to fail?
Mm-hmm.
And I ultimately realized that there's literally nothing I can change, right? That's the past. But the one thing that I guess if I could would be the interactions I had with other people, and especially my family, because I think that concept of hiding we've kind of been chatting about, there's an essence that hiding is like the absence of you attending something. It's the absence of you being somewhere else, when it's a very like intentional and active choice to hide. And to hide well, you have to constantly be thinking about how you're hiding. And I think for me, whether it's mannerisms, like how are my arms moving? Am I talking gay? Am I walking gay? Mm. The clothes I'm wearing, you know, does this look more metrosexual or so, you know, and like thinking about that constantly everywhere I go, and doing that every day. And I think some of that kind of going back to like ADHD is also that, I don't know, like I'm also like not very good at shopping because I want to go really fast. I want to like not have to try things on, but I have the agenda ahead of time. I don't know. It all comes together for me. I guess both of them are exactly the same.
Very related. I love what you said about like hiding being an active choice, and like I could see it both ways because I feel like other people, like straight people, cis people, neurotypical people, like I feel like maybe this isn't exactly what I mean, but like almost like I feel like it's almost like hiding is more of an active choice for them. And I feel like for me, it's kind of the opposite, that like being honest and being like transparent or vulnerable is an active choice I have to make. You know, there's so much about my identity that like, you know, is a choice to share, you know, like it takes a lot of like intentional action because people assume I'm neurotypical, because people assume that I'm straight, like just looking at me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of like, you know, having to put myself out there consciously that I think does a lot of like, I don't know, impacts the kind of relationships I have. Like if that has to be a step in making a relationship instead of just like having the common ground already, and then you can go from there. Like, does that make sense? I don't know what I'm saying, really.
Yeah, I definitely was going to ask a follow-up question. So you're sure saying that, like, for you, almost like, not hiding's the default, but, like, that, because I guess maybe for me, the idea of, like, the constant, like, coming out, that doesn't actually bother me. Like, I actually don't mind. I kind of enjoy that because like, when someone asks me, like, oh, you're dating or what's, like, for the first time in my life, I had an actual answer to give to people that felt like I wasn't hiding anything, or I was like actually sharing something authentic, and that gives me power, or not gives me power, but it gives me the sense of like control and that energy.
Totally.
And I think
maybe
for you that is like, well, I shouldn't have to do that. Like, it shouldn't matter if, you know, I'm gay, straight, if I'm dating or if I'm single. And I think that's totally valid too. I think it's just almost the difference in how we view whether that's part of our identity or a core part of our identity, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. Like having the comfort of being able to share it is definitely a game changer. And maybe this is like unique to my experience as a therapist, maybe just cause I think like making the constant judgment call of do I let slip that I'm gay to this client, you know, like, is like something that I have to do that other like straight therapists don't have to do, you know, like just this. Oh, maybe what I'm saying is like the concept that part of my identity is an issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it can't just be who I am. It has to be like I can't just, I mean, and sometimes I can't, but like in general, I always have to make the judgment call of like, if I mention my wife, is this session going to become about gayness?
Yeah.
You know? And like, I don't think that other, you know, straight people or neurotypical people have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's partly like your identity being politicized, but it's bigger than that. Do you know what I mean?
No, yeah, that makes total sense. And I feel like that at work too, where I'm constantly on Zoom calls, I'm talking to customers. And so building these working relationships with customers where, you know, if I'm doing my job right, and basically we want people to stay, our customers to stay with the company a long period of time. And so I should be talking to people for years, ideally, mm-hmm. right? And so knowing that kind of long-term aspect, it's very intentional for me if I decide to like reveal, like, to me, even the way I'm framing it now, reveal my sexual identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a reveal. It's not like that for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that was the other, like, my voice, the way, you know, when you said earlier, like, oh, you're going to have to hear your voice to gay at some point. Like, I had to get over that because I, like, trained myself to not try to have, like, a gay affect mm-hmm. as well. And it sounds terrible saying that out loud because... is this how I always had it, or did I have been more intentional about it? Because, again, actively trying to hide things when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, very true. Is there anything else about, like, coming out that you wanted to mention before I...
I would say one thing, and this was what I was actually going to say earlier, then I said I lost my train of thought.
Oh, good,
I knew I would come back to the station. Is that I don't think I would have gotten the diagnosis had I not come out. And
yeah, that's
I think
a
I,
great point.
I mean that in one very serious sense. I don't think I would have been alive. Mm-hmm. And then the second sense is that I then started to when I didn't have the secret I felt like I was carrying, I was able to put my energy towards other things in life. And then part of that was understanding, you know, all right, I don't have to talk to the psychiatrist all the time about like depression and, you know, how I want to get out of the bed in the morning and like, you know, go lead up. Things I can do to make me happy, right? And mm-hmm. kind of once I was able to better solve that problem, then I was able to say, you know, like, I'm having a really hard time, like, sitting still on the subway or, like, mm-hmm. traveling on, like, a four-hour plane ride. I feel like I can't do those things right now because the idea of sitting on a plane for 4 hours is terrifying to me right now. Mm-hmm. Or feeling, like, in work, like, Mike's not consistent because, you know, mm-hmm. he, like, loses or not, I don't even know, like, but just, again, like, the ADHD symptoms mm-hmm. that... were always there, and then not having the visage of like depression and my gender or my sexual identity, like thinking that was the reason, then that's what enabled me to then find a different psychiatrist who then was the one who ultimately diagnosed me.
Yeah, that's a really good, it almost sounded like a chain reaction that you described of like, you know, I came out so that I could, you know, maybe look at depression more, and then like looking at depression more, I could look at the ADHD more, you know, just that kind of like, almost like shedding layers.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like a lot of your depression maybe got better when you treated.
I would say it wasn't definitely right away. Cause I think mm-hmm. one thing I would want to say is, you know, that coming out when I said, you know, oh, this, once I told them, it was very easy, but no, like that, the first like kind of 8 months of that was really hard because mm-hmm. then I think what's kind of lost is that when you're being intentional about that, like, coming out moment, right? And I know some people say, like, that's a construct, you shouldn't have that. I think for me, it didn't feel like that just because, again, I had made such an intentional choice and this was me making a different decision for the first time. And through that, it's really that it was the first time I allowed myself to be gay, too. And mm-hmm. that took, like, a year of therapy after coming out to, like, get to that point. And mm-hmm. I'm still not fully there yet, but, like, way closer than I was before.
Yeah. I like how you said allowing myself. I think that's true. I think there's so much in, like... I mean, and I talk about this a lot, about, like, how much of, like, treating ADHD is not actually treating it. It's, like, allowing yourself to have ADHD, right? And mm-hmm. allowing yourself to be neurodivergent and, you know, just making allowances and space for yourself that you didn't before.
Yeah.
It was so constricting before. And it's probably a lot about, like... you know, coming to terms with sexuality as well. It's like, it's less about like treating it. It's not as simple as like, oh, you know, I feel like especially in, like, in media a lot of times, too, when they look at, like, these, like, self-hatred, you know, secretly gay people, you know, it's all about, like, oh, I'm gay and I hate that about myself, you know, when it's really not about that, you know, it's not that simple, you know, it's not just, like, I'm gay and I don't want to be, it's that, like, I'm gay and, oh my God, what else does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, and, like, I have to, like, reimagine everything about myself and my future and, you know, the way I interact with people, and it's something that's just kind of constant.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense, and that, like, constant thing, and I think initially what I challenged with is, so now is being gay, is that my, not just, like, core identity, is that my identity?
Yeah.
That takes a long time, too, to kind of be like, no, that's just a part of you, and you, that doesn't have to be something where, oh yeah, this is my cousin Mike, the gay one, or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, this is my cousin Mike, like, you should talk to him, he loves sports, too, or, you know, like, that's another one of those things, and one thing that I've always liked about our friendship and chatting with you is, you know, I would love for you to talk about ADHD all the time because A, I always learn something from you, and but B, sometimes the way that you talk about it or what drives you, like, I don't say symptoms, but your, like, behavior is almost the polar opposite for me. And the best example I have of that is time, where you talk about time blindness a lot, and it makes total sense to me about, like, you know, making sure you're on time for things or just not being worrying about how much time has passed. And it's like the exact opposite for me, but in the same debilitating way, I think you would feel that about the time blindness for you, is that I am so time sensitive. I'm constantly looking at time. I can tell you right now it's probably about 4:13.
It's 4:15.
Yeah, I'm really glad. You don't know how much easier you made this for me having the, like, time stamp showing
out.
Is that, like,
stressing you out?
No, no, it's the exact opposite, because now I know how much time has passed, and for me that becomes stressful, because I'm, like, going back to that 4-hour play flight, it's like, all right, I know I have to 4 hours, like, what am I going to do for 4 hours? And Louis says, like, okay, I got to get a crossword book at the airport. I got to get a paperback, or got to get, like, an airplane novel. I got to bring my toys. And so, like, that time sensitivity for us is so strong. It's just in polar ways almost. And again, I love having you talk about that, because I can learn more about how that affects me, just knowing that's something that you're, like, so acutely aware of as well.
Yeah. It's so funny, because I would consider myself very time sensitive as well. Like, it's something I'm constantly anxious about. Like, yeah. I literally have to tell myself, like, you have nowhere to be, you know? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, I just, even when I have an entirely free day, I'm always freaking out about what time it is.
Yeah.
And, like, it's, yeah, so it's just something that, like, even being aware of it and being anxious about it doesn't make it better.
Right.
But yeah, but you're right. It is very interesting and a widely, you know, varying experience of the same kind of impairment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you said that you're okay with me talking about ADHD a lot of times, because I could talk about it all day.
Yeah.
And I think if I really were to have to, like, pick one aspect of my identity that, like, not to define me, but to help people understand me, I think I would pick ADHD more than being queer.
Yeah.
I would say that, like, because there's so much about, you know, and even Hum would say this, like, learning more about ADHD has helped her understand me a lot better.
Yeah.
You know, like, and just, I think there's a lot about, you know, just constantly talking about what ADHD looks like that helps people get me more and helps me connect to others in a way that I don't think, like, learning about being gay would help people connect with me. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
It's, and I don't know if it's, I mean, both are very diverse experiences, you know. There are, like, so many ways to be neurodivergent, as many ways as there are to be gay, you know. It's, but I think that, I don't know, I wonder if there's just, like, maybe it's just at this point in my life, I feel like there's more unifying about neurodivergence than there is about being queer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense, and I'm not surprised you said that, and I feel like one thing I've noticed you kind of do in this conversation we've had is, I think sometimes I've, like, focused more on, like, the sexuality stuff. It's like, no, remember, like, got to bring it back. Like, we're talking about ADHD here, too. And it's, I think part of it is that I haven't really had that full talk therapy unpacking about, like, ADHD, because I've so heavily focused on that coming out period and that moment of time.
Yeah,
and
eclipses, yeah.
And I kind of, what you said there, too, about, like, you know, if somebody said, what is Abby's, like, core identity, or, like, the one sentence description you said of her, and of course, immediately I was like, won't that be for me? And I kind of thought about it, and then Well, something I've decided, I don't like that exercise because I think there's so many different things and maybe one sentence that's super apt for me on a Friday is totally wrong for me that next Monday or something. And if anything, that's what I like more about myself is that like kind of chameleon aspect and this just constant sense of looking for different things.
You like that about yourself?
Yes and no.
I didn't mean to sound like criticism.
No, because I think when I said it out loud, I think I used to look at that as a negative thing because I was using the chameleon powers again to hide. And so I was actively sabotaging myself because I was preventing myself from living a full, happy life by hiding. And the chameleon is then now one of those things where it's like, oh, but then I can be like good in other social settings and then not having that anxiety about worrying if I'm talking gay or talking too loud or something. It's just maybe I don't actually like talking in happy hours or something like that.
Oh, I love that metaphor you started with the chameleon. I'm just realizing that, like, I love how you looked at it because I think at this point in my life, especially, like, the isolating nature of the pandemic and losing a lot of those, like, you know, cues that I've gotten from other people about, like, okay, well, what's an appropriate amount of mad to be about this? Or, like, you know, what's an appropriate amount of, like, PDA? Or, like, what's an appropriate, you know, just losing all those senses have made me kind of dislike that about me, about needing so much of from other people to, you know, I think at this stage, it makes me more sad than anything of, like, I feel like I don't know who I am because I've done so much, like, adapting and changing and you know, changing colors. But I love that you emphasized, like, the freedom and the variability. Like, I like how, like, it's almost like, I don't know anything about chameleons, but, like, they, like, like camouflage, right? Like that's their whole thing.
I think so. Yeah, Chad would know all the answers to this. And, like, the difference. I was assuming, you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, you know, they're green when they're on the leaf, they're brown when they're on the branch, and then they're red when they're on the apple.
But, like, I feel like what you've hinted on is that, like, when you focus more on your ability to change colors rather than, like, what colors you're changing, I really loved that way that you were looking about it, like. You were saying, like, I like that I can, like, adapt to a lot of different things. I like that I can, you know, that I have so much diversity inside me. And, like, I love that. I think that's a really good way to look at it.
I knew that I would have an aha moment today. And I, and, like, that's such a great way you phrase that. And I want to write that down. And I'm definitely not going to write that down because, of course, I don't have a pen or pencil with me right now.
I do. Oh, shoot. I lost my pen.
But we recorded it. We're good.
Oh, great.
But that idea of not worrying about what colors you're changing into, but the fact that you can change colors, is that's so positive and powerful because then it's like you're just reframing something about yourself and you're not making it something that you're beating yourself about, but like, oh, this is like a skill, almost like that interview question, like, you know, ha, all my weaknesses are strengths, you know?
Psych.
And then look for other areas in your life or like, and I love this, like, tools in your toolbox, like the things that, you know, you use, whether that's an actual tool or just like mentally, you know, how to get through anxiety or stuff, is looking at other things like that and reframing them and not so negative and like, how does this actually help me versus maybe actively harm me?
That's funny. I feel like you gave me an aha moment. Like, I think it was the way you looked at it that it really made me see it in a different way. And, like, it's, you know, which is something I talk about all the time, you know, like, looking at ADHD symptoms in a different light. So I love that I can still, you know, be taught my own lessons all the time.
That's all for this episode, but there is plenty more at my website, theadhdmanual.com. That's theadhdmanual.com. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit at theadhdmanual. Do you have a question, comment, or story? Then I want to hear it. Email me at theadhdmanual@gmail.com. Very special thank you to my brother, Joe Miner, for composing this theme music, and thank you so much for listening. And remember to be kind to yourself. See you next time.